You were sitting in a machine.
Okay, so let's get started. So we are going to start some of the material for the course today. This is going to be an introduction to mostly computer architecture stuff. Okay, this is stuff that you need to know to learn operating systems. Okay, back in the old degree, we used to have a course called 201, which had most of this material. Now some of this should have migrated to 230. Okay, but I'm not sure how many of you have taken 201, how many of you have taken 230, and whether you remember either of those two things. So I'm going to do a refresher of computer architecture stuff. Stuff that you really need to know, the hardware stuff that you need to know to learn operating system. That's really the objective of today's class. So one course, one lecture, introduction to computer architecture. Okay, but before I do that, we'll do a two or three slide recap of what we did last time. This was the picture I put up, which says, which showed sort of what the operating system does for us. It's a piece of software that sits between the hardware and the users and the application, and it provides an easier to use interface to the user and or the application. It deals with all the underlying details of the hardware, hides some of that complexity from the users and application, and provides a better abstraction. Okay. We learnt about Moore's law. Okay. If you remember, it said Moore's law is basically an observation that says how quickly technology has improved and how that has impacted hardware capabilities, hardware design, and how operating systems have evolved with it. So that's some of the stuff we did last time. Today, really the objective is refresher of computer architecture and to look at the way operating system can leverage hardware features and how hardware features have evolved to support specific OS functionality. Okay, so we are going to do a bit of both, a refresher as well as how some of these hardware features are used by operating system kernel. And the point that the takeaway is, depending on what the hardware can do, okay, the design of the operating system kernel is either going to be more complicated or simplified. There are more features that are already present in the hardware. OS design becomes simpler because you can just ride on those features. If some of those features are missing, the OS still has to implement those in software. Okay, so that it can provide the same functionality to the end user. Okay, so hardware design matters from an operating system perspective as well. Yeah, that's really what we will see as we go along. Okay, just another couple slides of refresher before we delve into the OS, the hardware stuff. So we looked at operating system functionality from many different perspectives. I talked about concurrency. Basically, when we talked about uniprogramming and multiprogramming, I said the shift from uniprogramming to multiprogramming was facilitated by the observation that overlapping I/O and computation can make better use of the underlying hardware resources. Because when the applications are doing I/O, the CPU is idle. When the applications are doing computation, the CPU is busy, but the I/O devices are idle. So if you want to make use of all of the features in the hardware, okay, it is better to design the operating system such that you can overlap computation and I/O. So both the CPU as well as the I/O devices being busy makes the best use of all the functionality of the hardware. Okay. And this can be realized by having multiple users access the machine at the same time, have them start multiple applications, have the applications do different things, some doing I/O, some doing computation. Okay. And we'll come back to multiprogramming when we start looking at processes and threads and scheduling and whatnot. Okay, but concurrency is a key part of an operating system functionality. Okay. The other one is I/O devices. Okay, so the OS has functionality in it that allows it to access a variety of I/O devices. This is typically done through pieces of software called device drivers, which you must have heard of. Okay. If you attach a new piece of hardware to your machine, typically the OS needs a device driver in order to access it. The device driver is the piece of software that sits inside the kernel that allows the OS and hence all the applications to access that hardware. So managing I/O devices is another key functionality that the OS provides. Third one is memory management. This is where the OS arbitrates how memory is accessed and allocated to different applications and processes. Since you might have more than one process or app running in your OS, the OS has to decide what pieces of memory get allocated to which application and how much, which one should get more, which one should get less. All of those decisions are made by the operating system. Yeah. Files are another abstraction, so this is very much related to I/O, where the I/O device in question is a storage device like a disk, okay, or a USB drive or a CD-ROM or a DVD. Okay. The OS provides the abstraction of a file system which makes it easier for you, the user, to access your data. Okay. You don't have to deal with where on that storage device your bits are stored. Okay. The OS provides you this file abstraction that allows you to access this data. And last but not least, we have networking support and distributed system. Okay, this is the functionality where the OS allows you, the user, or your application to communicate with other users or other applications. Everything from email, web browsing, most of the applications that you see today are networked in some shape or form, and the OS has to provide functionality to enable that networking and that communication. So that's roughly the order in which we will also cover these topics in this course, but that was just a recap of some of the stuff that we talked about last time. Okay? And this is another take at looking at operating system. This is what it does rather than what components are in the OS. So we looked at operating system as a juggler. So I said, the OS arbitrates for resources. When multiple applications try to access a piece of hardware or any hardware resource, the OS does the arbitration. The OS decides in what order those resources get accessed, who gets access first, and so on. Okay. So or you can also think of it as a government, which is basically it makes sure that access to hardware or any resources is fair. Okay. That no processes or application should be favored over others. Everybody gets a fair share of the resources, whether it's the CPU time or whether it's disk access. The OS has to implement mechanisms to ensure fairness. Okay. We also talked about the OS as a complex software system. So if you remember, I talked about designing large pieces of software and trying to balance a trade-off functionality such as convenience and simplicity and functionality. So you, as a software designer, you have to decide what is the right balance. Okay? How much functionality do you put in, what kind of convenience do you provide, and do you trade speed for convenience or vice versa, or functionality and vice versa. Okay? And we looked at, we did a quick history lesson last time where we looked at how operating systems have evolved over the years. Okay? So that was recap from last time. Are there questions before I move on? Anything that has come up from last class or the discussion yesterday? Okay, so the only thing I will point out is we will be covering material at a fast clip. So please keep up with the material by going back to the book and reading up. Okay? That's already end of chapter 1. We are going to start chapter 2 today. It's mostly introductory material. There's not a lot of deep stuff there. But you do need to keep up. Okay, so today we will actually look at computer architecture. Okay. So this is a picture that you need to have in your mind throughout the class. Okay. This is basically what a typical personal computer looks like. Okay. Whether it's a laptop or a desktop, doesn't matter. Okay. These are the key components of a machine. Okay. That's what's inside a machine. The main thing is the CPU, central processing unit. That's basically where the actual computation happens. Okay. That's where your instructions get executed and whatnot. In today's world, so for a number of years or for decades, this used to be one processing unit that all your applications had to share. Okay. In today's world, we talk about multi-core CPUs. Okay, so there are, when you have this concept of a core, each core is essentially it's in an independent processing unit. So if you have a dual core or a quad core or an 8-core machine, you have 2, 4, or 8 of those processing units, all of which can execute instructions in parallel. So that's now for much of this course we will basically look at uniprocessor systems, okay, which means we'll look at, we will assume for simplicity that your CPU has a single core, okay, because whenever you have, we will talk a little bit about multi-core and so on, but that makes the operating system design more complex, because if you have multiple cores, you have parallel execution, there are more problems that arise from consistency and ensuring correctness and so on and so forth. Okay. So, when we talk about process management and threading and so on, we'll typically assume that there's one core there. But remember that that's no longer true for most systems you buy today. Even very inexpensive laptops or even smartphones today come with multiple cores. So it's important to understand the complexity that you have to put in the OS when you go from single core to multi-core, and we will talk a little bit about that, but much of the course will assume single core. Okay, that's the CPU. Okay, the memory is the other key component that's here. Okay, memory is where the data and the instructions for your application reside. Okay, so essentially what the CPU does is it fetches instructions from memory and it executes them, and the instructions might access data that also reside in memory. Okay. CPU and memory are the two key components of the hardware, and the OS, much of OS design deals with how to manage the CPU and how to manage memory. Okay, the first two components of the course will be process and thread management that deal with the CPU and memory management. Okay. Third major component, I/O devices, there are lots of them. Okay, so anything that you use to interact with the machine is an I/O device. So you have terminals or monitors, your disks, your video cards, your printers, your, and so on and so forth. Okay, anything that you use to interact, whether it's a USB drive and so on. Okay. Now, the OS has to have a mechanism to deal with a wide variety of I/O devices. Okay, so when we come to I/O management, we look at what are the key core functionality that you put in an OS that allows you to deal with any I/O device. Okay. Now, as you can imagine, the way the OS deals with a graphics card is very different from the way it might deal with a hard disk or a USB drive or a CD-ROM, very different kinds of devices. Okay. Yet, to simplify things, there is a common way the operating system can manage all these I/O devices, and we'll look at what those abstractions are and so on. Okay. Networking is another key component of any machine, whether this is a Ethernet card or a Wi-Fi card or a cellular modem, that's really a network card that you plugged into the machine. That's a key component. Okay. But as far as the OS is concerned, that is subsumed under this sort of this component. As the OS treats it as if it was an I/O device. Okay. So it will treat a network card no different from the way it treats a hard disk. So it's an important component, but it's subsumed under this this component. Okay. And last but not least, the system bus. So this is the interface that connects all of these components together. Okay. That's basically the thing that you use for the CPU to talk to memory, for the CPU to talk to the I/O devices, for memory to interact with I/O devices, and so on. Okay. So system bus ties it all together. Okay, so if you've heard of PCI and all of that kind of stuff, that's an extension of the system bus that you plug in I/O devices. Okay, any questions on this? This is all recap, so I'm assuming you know all this from 2:30 at least, or 2:01. Okay? Alright, so now let's go a little deeper. Okay, so we'll look at variety of operating system services, and we'll look at specific things that are implemented, specific functionality that's implemented in the hardware to support that feature. Okay? In many cases, the OS can still provide that service if that hardware feature is not available, but it makes the job of the OS harder to implement the same functionality. By implementing some of these features, it is easier for the OS to support these services. Okay? So we'll look at each of this in turn and see what hardware support exists to for that particular OS. Okay, so if you look at protection, we'll go through this in detail, but I'm just going to run through this quickly. So to provide protection, whether it's memory protection or protection from disk, the hardware feature that the OS depends on typically is user mode and kernel mode, protected instructions, and base and limit registers. And we'll go through all of those in just a moment. Okay, to implement interrupts, you have something called interrupt vectors in the hardware. Okay. To implement system calls, your trap instructions and trap vectors. Okay, we'll talk about what a system call is and what trap instructions are as well. To implement I/O, you have interrupts. Okay. To do job scheduling, whether it's process scheduling or thread scheduling, you use a hardware feature called a timer. Okay. To implement synchronization, there's something called atomic instructions that your instruction set contains. Okay. To do virtual memory, you have something called translation lookaside buffers or TLBs. Okay. I don't know how much of this you actually learned in 230, okay, but I'm going to go through all of that in any case, and we'll see how some of this enables OS rather to do its job better. Okay. So we'll start at the top and we'll go through this whole list. Okay, let's start with protection. Okay, so let's ask, what is protection? Why do we need it? What does the hardware do to help the OS implement protection? Okay, so as I mentioned last time, typical picture you should have in mind is what is called multi-programming, where the OS allows users to start as many applications or processes he or she wants. Okay, so you assume that you have some number of applications running. You may have your mail running, and you have a browser running, and you may have word processor, you may have a Eclipse running. All of these are processes as far as the OS is concerned. Okay. Now, the OS doesn't necessarily assume that all processes will be well behaved. Okay. You could certainly write a buggy program, okay, compile it and run it, and this program may do arbitrary things. It may do malicious things, it may do something that is plain dumb. Okay. But the OS has to somehow deal with both well-behaving processes as well as misbehaving processes. Okay. And the way it does this is to implement something called protection. Okay. Protection is a way by which one process is protected from what another process is doing, and the OS protects itself from misbehaving processes. Okay. So for instance, you don't want one process to read the memory contents of another process. Okay. That's implemented through protection. Now, why do you not want one process to read memory contents of another process? If you could, if the operating system allowed that, you could write a simple Java program or a C program that allows you to go and corrupt some other process, and you could make that process crash. Very simple. Okay. So you could basically write misbehaving processes that go and affect other well-behaved processes. So you don't want that to happen. And the way you will do this is you will prevent a process from even getting access to the memory contents of another process. So you could even think of security problem. You may be logged into your browser, through your bank, online bank through your browser, and browser essentially includes all the data that your online banking session is showing. If you had a virus, it could read the contents of your browser process, then it could actually access some sensitive data that is cached into your browser. You know, if you could prevent that through memory protection, then you will avoid such scenarios. Okay, so that basically says there has to be a way to protect one process from another, protect the OS from other processes, and so on. Okay, so how do you go about doing this? The simple way that is actually supported also by the hardware is through the notion of user mode and kernel mode. Okay, so what actually happens is the OS, or rather in this case the hardware, decides what are things that are okay for a process to do by itself and what are things that can actually impact the behavior of other processes. So anything that you can do to impact other processes or the operating system is protected, which means the user applications cannot directly access that functionality or execute that functionality. Okay, so for example, a user process or an application cannot do direct I/O. Okay, what this means is a user process cannot directly go and access raw bits from a hard disk, as an example. Yeah, if you could do raw I/O, you could go and read any any piece of data that's stored on your hard disk. If you could actually access any piece of data stored on your hard disk, you can access any file that may be created by other users as well. Okay, that's a security problem. Okay, so direct I/O, direct I/O is not allowed. Similarly, you don't allow applications to manipulate the state of memory. Okay, this will prevent applications from getting access to another process's memory, and so on and so forth. Okay, so you cannot, for instance, halt the machine. A user process cannot execute the halt instruction directly. Because if you could do that, obviously you could have any misbehaving program just issue halt and your machine will freeze. Okay? So some things that you can actually do on the machine, applications cannot do directly. But the OS can. Okay? So all of these things the OS can do, but a user process cannot directly do it. Okay? So now you can ask, so what if the user process had to access that functionality? How would it do it? Okay? Because it is prohibited from doing some of these things. And yet there may be legitimate reasons it has to do some of this. For simple example is file I/O. Okay? You know that you can write a Java program that opens a file and reads that file. That's I/O. Okay? But I just said that user processes cannot do I/O directly. Yet you know of a case where you are actually reading and writing files merrily and nothing is preventing your Java program from doing that. So how does that work? Okay? The way it works is I said that user processes cannot do some of those things directly, but the OS can. So if you have a user process that wants to do I/O, it has to ask the operating system to do it for it. Okay. So all of these things that are protected, the OS can do, and the user processes can request the OS to do it. And the OS will do it for that user process on its behalf. But since all of these requests are going through the operating system, the OS can do the write checks. Is the process allowed to do it? Is the process allowed to access this piece of memory? If that piece of memory belongs to another application, the OS can say, sorry, you are not allowed to access this piece of memory. If it's a file that belongs to another user that you cannot access, the OS can say you cannot access that file. Okay? So by preventing users or applications from doing this task directly and having the OS do it, you can add these additional checks so that protection can be implemented. Okay? So that's basically what protection is, why is it needed. Now let's ask, so how does the hardware help the OS do it? Okay, so we have convinced ourselves that there are certain things that are dangerous for operating systems to allow users applications to do directly. And the OS will do it on behalf of these applications. But how should we implement this functionality? Okay, the way the hardware helps you do it is that there is it has a notion of a user mode and a kernel mode. Or there's also, in Intel architecture, this is called rings. Okay, if you know what Intel architecture is, there's something called ring 0 and ring 1 and ring 2. That's essentially what is called user mode and kernel mode. Okay? So if you are executing, if the machine is executing, or the CPU rather, is executing in user mode, okay, then any instruction that does any of this is prohibited. If you actually try to execute that instruction in user mode, the CPU will refuse to execute it. It will say, I'm in user mode, you cannot issue any instruction that does I/O directly. But on the other hand, if the CPU is executing in kernel mode, okay, then all those instructions that do these tasks are allowed. Okay? And the assumption is only the OS can execute when the CPU is in kernel mode, and whenever a user program executes, the CPU always has to be in user mode. Okay? So user mode basically allows you to only execute a subset of the instructions that are supported by that CPU. Those are the safe instructions. Okay, that's where you cannot do any harm, even if you write buggy code. Okay? In kernel mode, any instruction that your CPU supports can be executed, okay, including the protected or the dangerous one. And what we do is the OS, only the OS runs when the CPU is in kernel mode, because we only trust the OS to do the risky stuff for us. We never allow the user applications to do all this stuff that can cause problems. Okay? Any questions here? Okay? Now the way you support this is simply through a bit. Okay? Your CPU actually supports a status bit. And if the status bit is 0, then you are in kernel mode. And when the status bit is 1, then you are in user mode. And whenever any instruction is executed, you check are you in user mode and kernel mode, and if you are in user mode, is this an instruction that is allowed in the user mode, and only then you allow it to execute it. So very simply, if you are in user mode and you try to issue the halt instruction, you will get an error. You will say you are not privileged, this is a privileged instruction, you cannot execute it in user mode. If you are in kernel mode, you can actually execute halt. Okay, so any questions here? Okay, so I talked about two or three different things. One is there are certain things application or processes can do, cannot do, that only the OS is trusted to do. And then I talked about this notion of user mode and kernel mode and switching between. So now let's ask the question saying, now that we buy all this, okay, how is it that a user process can do something privileged? Okay? How do you ask the OS to do some IO on your behalf? This is done through what is called a system call. Okay, whenever an application wants to do something that is protected, you have to ask the OS to do it for you. And this is done by calling an OS function. Okay, that OS function is called a system call. Okay, the system call allows the OS to do some stuff that is protected on behalf of the user process. Is that clear what I said? Yes? Okay. So, here's a picture of what a system call looks like. Okay, so let's assume that this gray box on the top is a user process. Okay, that's the user process. This gray box at the bottom is the kernel process. Okay, the OS kernel. You have a question?
Yes. Sorry to interrupt. Can we actually change the light situation? It's kind of hard to read that a little bit. We can flip the lights so that they are off.
Okay, I will flip the lights, but then the video will go dark that we are recording there. Is that better? Okay. All right. So we'll keep it this way. Don't go to sleep. Okay. Okay. So so the gray box at the top, user process, gray box at the bottom, kernel. Okay. Here is your user process executing. Let's say at this point, and this is time. Okay. So let's say at this point in time, you want to open a file and read something from that file. Okay. That's I/O. Okay. We don't trust processes to do I/O directly. So you have to call the OS and ask it to read the file for you, and it will just return the results of whatever you tell it to do. Okay? So you make a system call saying go read this file. You could issue what is called a read system call. Okay, what this will do, this what the system call will do is it will essentially suspend the execution of the user process, and it will basically cause the OS kernel process to execute. Okay? The kernel process will start executing, and it will actually say that this user has asked me to execute this system call. It will execute that code for that system call, which involves running protected instruction. So here you are in kernel mode. Okay. In this point in time, you are in kernel mode. Until you executed the system call, you are in user mode. So when you switch to the kernel, you are always in kernel mode. So it will execute that system call. In this case, it's reading a file. You go to disk, you get the data. Okay, and then you will return that whatever you read from that disk back to the user process. So here you will suspend execution of the kernel, switch back to the user process, hand it the results of the system call, saying here is the data you wanted to read from the file you are trying to access, and then the user process will start executing again. Okay, is that clear? What has just happened? So you basically are in user process. That's executing, that's in user mode. You want to do something privileged, you make call the OS function, because you are not allowed to do it, you ask the OS to do it for you. Then you suspend execution, you switch to kernel mode, the kernel starts executing, it does the work for you, returns the result, continue execution. Okay. Now there are some details here that I glossed over. You can ask, how did you actually switch from here to here? Okay, what caused the system call to switch from user mode to kernel? This is typically done through what is called a trap. Okay, trap is like an interrupt. I don't know if either you heard the word trap or interrupt before. I assume you have. Okay, so you basically, the system call, when you make that system call, you raise a trap. Okay, trap is like an interrupt, and we'll come back to traps in a few slides. That trap will cause you to go to a trap vector. Okay, the trap vector will execute an interrupt service routine, which is executed in kernel mode. That's what is actually here. Okay, that's the system call itself. Okay, and then once you're done, you will basically switch the mode back to user mode and return from that trap. Okay, so essentially system call is like doing interrupt service. servicing an interrupt. Okay, it allows you to switch from user mode to kernel mode in this case. Okay. Any questions on this? Is this clear? If you are puzzled, you should ask a question. If it's clear, then I'm going to move on. Okay, so that's basically crossing protection boundary. So what we have just learned is by having this notion of a trap supported in the hardware, you made the way the task of switching from user mode to kernel mode and doing all the system call much easier. If traps are not supported in the hardware, doing this would be much harder using an operating. So this is how hardware is the hardware design is supporting the operating system in some sense. Okay, so here are some examples of system calls. Okay, so I don't know if you are programmed at a system call level. Typically, when you program in Java or even in C for that matter, you program to a library API, okay, which is much higher level. So inside the library, you are actually making system calls. So in Java, if you do things like IO streams and so on, and you read and write files, you are not issuing system calls. You just call a library function. The JVM has implemented this library. It is making the system call for you. So there is a system call that is being invoked when you do file IO, but you don't issue that. The library routine that you call issues it for you. Yes, question.
So since the instructions, the system calls themselves are dependent on the operating system, so like, if you're using Java or something, how is it, does it just have to, know what operating system you're using in order to make those calls?
So the question is, system calls are dependent on the OS. Okay, the system calls that you will have, in this case, these are Linux calls. Okay, in the next slide, I have some Windows system calls, the Win32 system calls. They are somewhat different. Okay, so how is that dealt with? So in Java, you don't change your library API depending on whether you are running on Linux or Windows or Mac. You are just doing the same thing. Okay, so this is actually dealt with by the library. In this case, it's dealt with by the JVM. The JVM implementation is designed for a particular platform, whether it's Linux or Mac or Windows. So the JVM, the people who wrote the JVM will actually invoke the right system call on the right platform. So the JVM implementation will differ across platforms to use the right OS APIs, which are the system calls. Okay? So this is just a flavor. We will come back to system calls next time, and you will have a lot more to do with system calls than you do the first assignment. First assignment will have something to do with system calls, so you program at that level. Okay? So these are process management system calls. So this system call called fork actually creates a new process. This is how you start new applications on your system. Okay, there is the exec and there's wait, and exit allows you to exit an application. These are file management system calls. This is how you open a file. This is how you read data from a file. So whenever you try to read anything from a file, at the OS level, this translates to a read system call. Okay, regardless of whether you're doing this in Java or C or C++, all your either the JVM or the C library or the C++ library will actually make this system call at the lowest level to read data from this. Yeah, that's the write system call, there's a seek system call, and so on. Okay, you don't need to know every single system call that's supported. This is just to give you a flavor of what kinds of things you can do with system calls. Okay, the Win32 API, similar things. Okay, so you can have a create process system call to create a new process, have a create file call to create a file, and so on and so forth. Okay. As you will see, the names of these functions differ. Okay, and this is why I was saying that when you implement the library, you have to know what OS you are writing it to. Okay, so you issue the right system calls and do the right stuff. Okay? Okay, so the next piece, so we are not done with protection. We only looked at one part of protection, which is user mode and kernel mode and protected instruction. The next piece is memory protection. Okay, so I said that somehow the OS should prevent one process from accessing the memory contents of another process so that you don't go and corrupt another process's memory. Or worse, you don't go and corrupt the kernel itself and crash the machine. Okay? So how do you go about doing that? So the way this is done, again, you need hardware support to make it easier. The simplest way to do this is to have two registers supported by the hardware called a base register and a limit register. Okay, there are many other mechanisms. and we'll come back to many of them when we do memory management. This is the simplest one just to give you a flavor. Okay? So think of this box here as RAM. Okay? So that's your main memory on your machine, and what this is showing is that the OS kernel is running and there are four jobs or applications running all at the same time, and this is the piece of memory they are loaded in. Okay, this is where the OS resides, and this is where job 1 instruction and data reside, and job 2 and job 3. Okay. So whenever a process is executing, what happens is you basically take the start location of that process and the end location of that process and you load it into the base and the limit registers. Okay? The start location of the process goes into the base register, that's the base of the process. The end address, end memory address of that process is loaded into the limit register. And so now what you do is whenever this process tries to access any piece of memory, any memory address whatsoever, you just check that memory address against the base and limit register. And that memory address has to lie between these two. If it's out of bounds, you say you cannot access that because that memory does not belong to you. And you'll basically get a trap. Yes, or segmentation. Yes,
is question. Is there ever a case where the OS would have to deal with fragmented memory?
Okay, question is there a case where the OS would like to, would have to deal with fragmented memory? That is always the case.
Right.
This is a gross simplification of what actually happens in the OS. This is what early operating systems and early CPUs did. Okay, clearly this is not going to work if you have fragmented memory, because if you have parts of a process residing here and the same parts of that process residing there, this clearly is not going to work. Okay? So this is what old operating system and old CPUs did. Okay, today we have far more sophisticated hardware. We will talk about paging and page tables that essentially do the same thing. Essentially you need to be able to check, does this memory address that you are trying to access belong to you? If it doesn't belong to you, you shouldn't access it. The simplest way is to do what's called contiguous memory allocation, where the entire process is in one lower region, not fragmented, and you simply check against a range, the start and the end, and if you're out of bounds, you can't access it. And if you're fragmented memory, you have to have more sophisticated checks. Okay, but we'll come back to that when we do memory management. For now, just to give you a flavor of what is there in hardware. Yes, question.
So I'm guessing that the OS actually handles all of the address that maybe the program would only know that I can call a range from 0 to 100, and the OS will know that actually means like from 129 to 229.
Yes.
Or something.
Yes. So you are asking a slightly different question, which is processes issue what are called logical addresses. These are addresses with respect to the start of that process, offset with regards to the start, but internally there is also a translation going on saying if this application is loaded here or is loaded there, you have to first translate what's the actual memory address. So you do logical to physical address translation, then you check against the range. Okay, all stuff that we'll come back to in lots of detail, we'll show you flow charts of how this works and so on and so forth. Yes, but you have to do all of that. Okay, yes, question.
So like every time you switch between jobs, if you're doing like multi-programming, do you have to change the base and memory register every time?
Yes, good question. So every time you switch between processes, you have to switch what is stored in this register. So if the application OS starts running this job, running this process, then it has to take its base and limit registers and load it there. Okay, so that is called the state of that process. So before you start executing any process, you have to restore the state of that process. So that includes the base register, limit register. It also includes what's called the program counter. That's basically the instruction and executing and so on, and stack pointers and so on. Yes.
Is this virtual memory or is this physical memory?
So this is physical memory. This is actual RAM. Okay, we have not talked about virtual memory yet. Okay, so that's memory protection. So the only takeaway here is, in the grossly simplified case where you're doing contiguous allocation, you can do memory protection using two registers. If you have more sophisticated memory management schemes, you need more sophisticated hardware, something that we will not talk about now. We will come back to that. Okay, but this is just to show you what is actually can be done using hardware. Okay. Now, before I move on, I just want to put up a logical view of what a process looks like in memory. Okay, this is a logical view, not a physical view. So if you take any executing process, okay, it has three regions, also called segments. Okay, you may have heard of them. Okay, it's called the code segment or the text segment. There's something called the stack segment, something called the data or the heap segment. Okay, So these are the pieces of memory that the that belong to a process. Okay, what is stored in the text segment is actual code. These are instructions that your process is executing. Okay, any code that you write gets translated into assembly instructions in the end, and those assembly instructions reside in the text segment. And then you just go through this and you keep executing it. Okay? And so that's really the code. All the other segments are essentially data segments. Okay, data meaning they store variables and arrays and all of that kind of stuff. So there is the stack. Okay, so there are two kinds of data segments. The stack segment and the heap segment. Here the heap is called a data segment. So I hope you heard the word stack and heap and so on. Okay, so whenever you do dynamic memory allocation, that piece of memory is actually allocated on a stack. When you do new and things like that. Okay, so you have run constructors. In Java, you will basically allocate memory on the heap segment. If you call functions, okay, basically all of the variables or parameters that you've passed onto a function and all statically allocated variables are actually allocated on the stack segment. Okay, so the heap is dynamic memory, stack is something that is already assigned variables. Yes, question.
Is the address space for each one of those three segments distributed evenly as shown like on that there, or is it would have more address space in the data?
Question is, how is the address space for the stack segment and heap segment decided? So first thing you should realize is that the code segment is static. The program is not going to generate new instructions as it executes. That is what the programmer wrote, and that's all that we need to allocate. So this is never going to change. This is the code that you wrote. The two segments that will change in size as the process executes are both the heap segment and the stack segment. This depends on how much memory you allocated on the fly or how many functions you've got. Okay? So the short answer to your question is that the size of these segments will change on the fly. Okay? You cannot say that the stack is going to be bigger than the heap or the heap is going to be bigger than the stack. You don't know. That depends on the process. You may have small stacks and large heaps, large stacks and small heaps. We don't know a priori. So you must find a way to allow them to grow dynamically. So what this picture is showing is that it's showing that you have allocated some amount of memory statically to a process, and your code resides here, your heap resides here, and it grows upwards. The stack resides at the top and it grows downward. And this is unallocated memory that you can allocate either to the stack or the heap. Okay? So in this case, the process can never grow beyond this size, which is also a simplification. That's not the case in reality. Your heaps can grow quite a bit. Okay? But there is a limit. It's not that there is no limit. There is a limit. But here what this shows is if your stack grows to this point and you try to do another call a constructor, your program is going to crashing out of memory. Okay? So the simplification. But that's a good enough view for us for now. Okay? So the short answer is we don't a priori decide how much to allocate. We just say you grow upwards and stack grows downwards, and if you grow, this grows faster than that, it takes more memory than the other, or vice versa. Okay? So that's the stack, heap, and the text, and the reason we talked about that will be clear in just a moment. Okay, so now we'll come back to the hardware features, and those are, in this case, we are going to talk about registers and memory hierarchies and so on. So you should have heard the term register at least. Okay, so this is basically a fast piece of memory that's managed by the CPU. But what is more important from our perspective are the types of registers, because from an OS perspective, OS manages some of these registers for a process. Okay? Whenever you have a process, it is going to have some registers assigned to it. Okay, so we have general purpose registers and special purpose registers. A general purpose register is one which you can assign any variable. Any frequently used variable can actually be stored in a general purpose register. And by doing so, access to that variable becomes faster than if you had put that piece of memory, variable in main memory. Okay? Special purpose registers, on the other hand, have a specific purpose. And the three that we care about from an OS standpoint are the program counter. Okay, this register actually points to the piece of the specific instruction in the code segment that you're currently executing. Okay, program counter is not shown there, but a program counter typically points somewhere in here, and wherever it points, that's the assembly instruction you're currently executing. Okay, and then once you execute that instruction, you go to the next one and so on and so forth. Okay. And the stack and the frame pointer essentially capture the beginning of the stack frame and the beginning of the end of the stack frame and so on. So it basically points to the piece of memory where the stack is stored. Okay? We also talked about base and limit registers. Those would be additional registers that would capture the beginning and the end of the process, if that is the memory management your CPU supports. Okay, typically most CPUs today don't do base and limit registers. They allow you to fragment memory. Okay, that's why I haven't put those here. Okay. Now OS, the operating system, is responsible for these. Okay. It needs to track where the stack begins, where the stack ends, what instruction is being executed, and so on and so forth. Okay. So that brings us to the point that was asked earlier, which is whenever you switch from one process to another, you have to do this task. You have to save what is called the context of that process, which is you have to save all the registers, okay, into memory. Okay. And when you start executing a new process, you have to load its the previous contents of its register into the register. Because if you switch from one process to another, the program counter has to now point to the text segment of the new process. Okay. If you simply override the program counter, when you resume the previous process, you have no idea where it was executing. Okay. So you always have to save what the current process was doing, which means save all these register values somewhere, so that you can restore them when you resume execution. Okay, that's the OS's job. Okay, the OS is going to do this for you. It is going to take all the register values, store them somewhere. When you resume execution, it's going to reload those values back into those registers. Okay, so as far as the process is concerned, nothing has changed. Okay, the OS is doing all the hard work. Okay, now, let me just not do the animation. So we talked about registers, we talked about RAM. Okay, but if you actually look at any CPU today, there's actually a memory hierarchy. There are other pieces of quote-unquote memory that are not directly visible, but that help with performance. Okay, these are the L1, L2, and the L3 caches. Okay, so what a cache is, it's a smaller piece of memory that stores frequently executed instructions or frequently accessed data items in them, so that access to them is faster. Okay, then going to main memory, which is slow. So as you go up the memory hierarchy, you get faster and faster access, faster and faster accesses, and it's also more expensive to implement those that functionality. So registers are the fastest pieces of memory you have on a machine. Then you have the L1 cache, which can store some instructions, and the L2 cache, and I haven't shown the L3 cache here, which most of the CPUs today have. Then you have main memory. And then you actually have disk. You can think of disk as one more level in the hierarchy, which is some several orders of magnitude slower than memory. Okay, remember that when you compile code, it is actually stored in a file, okay, which is stored on disk. You can bring that into memory and start executing it and so on. Yes, question.
So for the L1 and L2 cache, is that also operating system managed, or is that available to the programs?
Okay, question is, L1 and L2 cache are managed by the operating system, or is it accessible to program? Typically, caches are not accessible to programmers. Okay? You could write code that says, I want to store this piece of where the registers are visible to you, RAM is visible to you. In some sense, you can manage RAM by managing the heap. You can even, if you write assembly code yourself, you can manage register. But L1, L2, L3 caches are not directly accessible to you. They're only seen by the hardware and the operating system. So the hardware will manage some of that automatically for you, and the OS has some control over it, but not accessible to programmers. And the reason for that is this is simply a performance optimization. Your program would run absolutely correct even if you didn't have these caches. All that these are doing is they're speeding things up. Okay, so that's the reason you don't need to deal with it. It's just a way for a mechanism that allows your program to run faster. Okay, so but you don't need to directly manage it or even know of its existence. But they are there, and they're helping you in terms of speeding up your memory. Okay, so here's a slide that gives a little more detail. Okay, so access, the reason you have these caches is access to main memory is expensive and slow. By expensive, I mean slow. Typically, it requires 100 clock cycles to go and fetch a piece, a word from memory, a byte or an integer or some such thing from memory. Okay, so for 100 cycles, you are just going to go and fetch, and nothing is happening on the CPU. So if you want to speed things up, you put frequently access stuff, whether it's data or instruction, in a cache. Okay? And you have different caches, you have different levels of caching. Your L1 cache, level 1 cache, that's typically on the chip itself, next to the core. Okay? It's small, but it's fast. Okay? Now, L2 cache, that may be on chip or just outside the chip, that's bigger than the L1 cache, it's somewhat slower, but bigger. And L3 is even bigger, okay, but somewhat slower than L2 cache. Okay? So, multiple levels of caching. Okay, so L3 cache will have a subset of your process cache there, instructions, data. L2 cache will have a subset of what's in L3. L1 cache will have a subset of what's in L2. Okay, so the most frequently accessed stuff you put here, or not, you don't put here. The OS and the hardware puts it there automatically for you. Okay, and then the next most frequently stuff accessed stuff is here, and then here, and everything else is in RAM. Okay, or disk, as we will see. Okay. So as far as the OS is concerned, I mean, it will do some cache management, specifically TLBs and so on, but they are not visible to the applications. Okay. So the next thing we are going to talk about is traps. We already mentioned traps when I said something about system calls, but now let's come back to traps and look at what they are, how they are implemented in the hardware. Okay. So think of traps as special conditions that are detected by the hardware. Okay, so this could be something like divide by zero. Okay, you can write a program that does divide by zero. It's clearly an error. You can't divide by zero. And whenever you try to execute an instruction that does divide by zero, that's going to raise a special condition saying an error has occurred. Okay, this is, so in this case it says that you can't actually do divide by zero. But there are many other special conditions. You can have what is called a page fault. We'll talk about what a page fault is. I'm not going to explain that. You can try to write to a read-only page. Okay? Certain pages or certain regions of memory are marked read-only. Okay? If you try to write to it, if you try to modify it, you're going to get an error or a trap saying that you're trying to write to a read-only region of RAM. Okay? You could execute a system call that's also a special condition where the user process is explicitly signaling the OS saying, go do something for me. So whenever any of these conditions occur, you have essentially a trap. A trap is like an interrupt. So on detecting a trap, okay, what the hardware and the OS will do is the following. We'll first save the state of the process. Okay. What does that mean? Okay. You're going to save all the register values. Okay, because you're suspending the execution of that process. Okay. Remember, when I said whenever you suspend execution of the process, you take all the register stuff and you store it somewhere, so that you can reload it when you resume execution. Okay. First thing you will do when a trap occurs is you are going to save the state of that process. Okay. And then you will basically jump to what is called a trap handler. The trap handler is the piece of code that is going to do something for based on what the trap is. Okay. So if you are trying to write to a read-only page, you are going to terminate the process, saying that you are doing something that is bad or an error, so we will basically stop the application from executing. If you are trying to execute a system call, you will jump to the piece of code that resides in the kernel that is going to execute that function for you. You basically jump to that function and start executing. Okay, so essentially you will basically go to what's called a trap handler, which is an OS routine, which will check what the trap is and then basically jump to the right piece of code, which will execute, which will service the trap essentially, which will do something about the trap, and then you will come back to that process and resume execution, unless you terminated it already. So on completion, you will basically go back and restore the state of that process. You are going to take all these register values, restore it, and resume execution. Okay? Is that clear? I'm going to show a picture here. So this is what is called a trap vector. Okay. That's basically hardware support for traps. Okay, is what is referred to as a trap vector. Think of a trap vector as a table. Okay, it's a table that you index. Every trap is given a unique number, 0 through n. Okay, so suppose that your hardware supports n traps. Okay, maybe n is 16. In this case, your trap numbers will go from 0 through 15. Okay. So what a trap vector does is basically it will have one entry for each trap. And that entry is the memory address where the function for servicing that trap resides. Okay, is that clear what I said? So trap vector is a table. Okay. And for every trap, whether it's trap 0, trap 1, trap 2, trap 3, you are going to have a memory address. That memory address will point to the region of the OS kernel that the function for handling that trap resides. So very simple example is, if your user process invokes a system call, okay, in this case system call is trap number 3. Okay, so a system call will raise trap 3. So what the OS will do is it will go to this table and say, how do I handle trap 3? So what it does, it will say, okay, basically you just get this address. Okay, so what it will do is it will simply go to this address in memory and just start executing whatever instructions reside there. Okay, and those instructions in this case are instructions to execute that system call. Okay, this is essentially how interrupts also work. If you have interrupts, if you heard of interrupt service routines and so on, in 201 or 230, it's the same concept. Okay, slightly different reason for doing that. Yes, question.
Would each call have its own trap, or would there just be one trap for a system call?
Okay. So for simplicity, we'll assume each system call has its own trap, but that's not really true. What will happen is there's a generic system call trap. You'll go there, there's another table for every possible system call. Otherwise, since this is a piece of hardware, if you only support n traps, that means you cannot have more than n system calls. That restricts you as an OS designer. If I want to have the 101st system call and you say, oh, this piece hardware only has 100 entries in its trap vector, I cannot do it, then I'm out of luck, right? So what you will do is you'll basically have this point to another table where you can have any number of system calls. Okay, so that's the short answer. But let me again show that thing using an example. This is your trap vector. And this is basically RAM. That's the kernel. Okay. So in this case, we have trap number 3 is system call, and let's say that is region 100 and memory address 127. Okay, let's say that is 127, and here is where the system call function resides. Okay. So whenever the user process issues a system call, you will come look saying that's trap 3. Okay. How do I execute trap 3? You go to this memory address and you execute whatever code resides there. So the OS will actually jump there, and that is where the system call code resides, and you will start executing this function. Okay, and that will allow you to execute that system call. Once you are done executing this function, you will go back to the user process, okay, and resume execution saying, here are the results of your system call. Okay, yes, question.
Yeah,
the
trap vector is actually located in RAM
too, right? Yes. So I didn't show you something which is this region is actually also here. Okay, but that's true. Okay, that's all of this is part of the OS kernel. Okay, any questions here? Okay, should be clear what is a trap, okay, how is it handled, and what the hardware does for you. Okay, so a couple more concepts and then we are done. So now we are going to talk about I/O. Okay, so before I actually do that, let me go back to the picture that I showed you for system calls and just review what traps do. Okay, so remember, this was the system call picture where I said you are in user mode, make a system call, you execute that system call, and so on. Okay, this picture now you should try to correlate with this. So what happens is when you issue this system call, you are going to raise a trap. In this case, it's going to be trap number 3. Okay, trap number 3 is going to point to this region of memory. Okay, this is a piece of memory that is basically that. Okay, and so you will jump here, you will execute this. Once you are done, you are going to come back to the user process and resume execution. Okay, that's essentially what is happening there. Okay, is that clear? Okay, so now we'll talk about I/O. You know, this requires us to understand what an I/O device is. Okay, typically, an I/O device, I/O is input or output, obviously. I/O device could either be doing input or output or both. Okay, from our perspective, it doesn't matter. All I/O devices will have the following form. Okay, each of this device will have some piece of hardware that you are interacting with, and there is a small tiny processor on each of these I/O devices. That processor, think of it as a tiny CPU that resides on the I/O device. You have your main CPU, and every I/O device comes with a tiny microcontroller. It's like a small processor that sits on that device. And what this microcontroller does is it accepts commands from the OS, okay, and it executes those commands. Okay. So if you have a disk, on the disk you will have a tiny microcontroller that will allow that accepts I/O commands from the OS and go read this piece of storage and go write to this piece of storage, and it will do whatever the OS is telling it to do. Okay. If it's a graphics card, you will again have a small processor that will say go output these pixels to this region of your display, and it will go and do the right thing. So you can think of any I/O device, regardless of whether it's a disk or a network card or a graphics card or anything else, as using this abstraction that I/O device is a tiny processor that enables it to, first of all, it will run autonomously. It will run independently of the main CPU. Okay, so both will run in parallel. Okay, and second is CPU always issues a command to these I/O devices, and typically it's not going to wait. It will say go do this, and it will continue doing something else. Okay, and then the I/O device is going to go execute the command that was issued to it, and it will return the results back to the main CPU or the OS. Okay? And when the I/O request completes, the CPU is going to stop doing whatever it was doing, go back to that I/O device and read the results back from that I/O device. Okay, I'm going to show a picture of how all of this works, but this is the main idea. Any I/O device, the way it is going to work, okay, so you have a CPU here. Okay, let's assume that's a disk. Okay. There's a tiny processor here. Okay, the CPU is going to issue commands to this device by saying read and say something or write. Okay, and then it's going to continue doing something else. Okay, because it's not going to wait for a disk. iOS devices are slow. So you typically don't wait for your command to finish. You issue it and you continue doing something else. Okay? And the disk processor is going to go off and start executing this command, okay, in parallel to the CPU. So it's going to do read, which means it's going to go to some region of disk, read the contents of it and so on. Once it's done executing the command, it's actually going to raise an interrupt. Okay, similar to a trap saying, I am done with whatever you told me to do. Okay? The CPU at this point is going to save whatever the state of whatever it was executing. It was executing a process, is going to save that. It will go back and say what are the results of that command I issued and read it back. Okay, and then it's going to do something with it. If the process issued this file I/O, it's going to hand that piece of data back to that process. Okay? So all of I/O works like this. Whether this is a disk or a network, or a graphics card, it doesn't matter. It's going to use the same concept. Okay, so you deal with all these I/O devices using this common framework. Okay, that makes it easy for you to write device driver, because you have to deal with all of them in sort of similar way. The only thing that's different is the command set that this device will accept. That'll depend on what the device is. Okay, so with that in mind, I'm going to talk about three types of I/O, and we'll come back to all of this. This is just for you to understand at a high level how I/O work. Okay? What I talked about right now is what is called asynchronous I/O, as shown in this picture here. Okay, so you have a requesting process that issues a command to the device driver, okay, in the kernel. The device driver actually issues that command to that processor here. Okay, the device driver is in the OS, so it's going to issue that command in that processor, and it's going to continue. And then your hardware is going to go off and do its own thing, and once it's done, it's going to raise an interrupt. Okay, that will suspend execution of whatever was happening on the CPU, get the results of your I/O command, and you are done. Okay? The reason this is called asynchronous is that the requesting process or the CPU doesn't wait for your I/O to complete. Okay? It will continue executing something else. You are not waiting. That's why it's called asynchronous. Okay? So that should tell you that there is something called synchronous I/O, which is on this figure here. And asynchronous I/O is simply going to be somewhat different from here, and this is the picture. Okay? Requesting process issues an I/O command to the device driver. Device driver sends that command off to the processor, and the hardware goes and starts doing its thing. But in synchronous I/O, the requesting process will block. It will wait for that request to complete. Okay, it's not going to do anything. So it will wait for the results to come back, and then it will resume execution. Okay, synchronous I/O you block, asynchronous I/O you don't block. Two very fundamental forms of I/O. Okay, any process application that you write, you have to decide, are you going to use synchronous I/O or asynchronous. Typically any program that you have written so far probably has done synchronous I/O. Right? When you do a file read at a process level, okay, you do Java I/O streams and whatever, you try to read from a file, your process is actually waiting for that read to complete, or when you issue a write, you wait for that data to be returned to that file. Okay? So you are actually at a process level doing synchronous I/O. Okay? You could use asynchronous I/O abstraction. Java supports it, many other programming languages support it. Much harder to write, okay, but more efficient, because you don't have to wait for slow I/O to complete. You can go out, do some other useful work in the meantime. Okay? So at a process level, typically when you do I/O, you try to do synchronous I/O. At an OS level, everything is asynchronous. What the OS will do is, just because your process is waiting for this file read to complete, it's not going to let your process hog the CPU, saying there's nothing to do. I'm going to suspend execution of that process and do something else. And when the file I/O is complete, at that point I'll resume execution of your process. In the meantime, there is no reason for me to let your process sit on the CPU and do nothing. Okay? So at an OS level, always asynchronous, best use of the CPU. At a process level, you decide. You are the programmer. Do you want to do synchronous or asynchronous? Okay? By default, when you do I/O, you are doing synchronous. That's the easiest thing to do. But you can do asynchronous as well. But from an OS standpoint, it's always efficient at a OS level to do something like this. Not let a waiting process just sit on the CPU idly. Okay? You will do some resume execution of some other process and do something useful. Okay? Any questions on synchronous and asynchronous? There's a third I/O method that I'll talk about called memory mapped, which is different from either of these two. Okay? What happens in memory mapped I/O is that there is a slight difference in abstraction. So what you do is you take the device memory and you actually map it into a region of main memory. And then you access this device as if you are reading and writing to main memory rather than you are actually accessing a device itself. Okay? And by doing this, you simplify how you interact with this device. And I'm going to give an example that just explains what I just said, because I presume that what I said is not very easy to understand without an example. So let me draw another picture. Okay, so now let's try to do the following. Instead of we'll use the same thing, but we'll call this a graphics card. And then this graphics card is going to output whatever you write to it to a display. Okay? The I/O device we are going to consider is graphics card. Okay, so it's like in the previous case, this is a tiny processor. And if you did asynchronous I/O, what you would do is every time you have to refresh the graphics card, you would actually issue a command to the graphics card. The graphics card would go and do whatever you told it to do, output some pixels or output a picture here, and then it would raise an interrupt. And this is how your asynchronous I/O would work. And memory mapped I/O will allow you to do this in a much simpler way. And what will happen in memory mapped I/O is the buffer that you have in the graphics card is going to get mapped into RAM. Okay, so let me draw a different picture. Okay, so CPU, that's RAM. Graphics card, and that's your display. Okay, so the way graphics card work is there is basically a buffer that corresponds to that, and there's a piece of memory that corresponds to each pixel. Depending on whether a pixel on your screen is red, blue, green, you write the appropriate value there, and depending on the value, it will display red, blue, or green, whatever that color is. Okay, this is how graphics card work. Okay, now the way you will simplify this is rather than issue a command say go write a red pixel at location X, go write a green pixel at location Y, go write a blue pixel at location Z, very cumbersome because you might have like 10,000 pixels on the screen, so to update the screen you have to issue 10,000 commands. Okay? not very efficient. A better way to do it is what is called memory mapped IO. So what you will do is you will take that entire screen, okay, and each pixel, and you will assign a memory location in RAM for it. And so update this screen, rather than issuing a command, you will simply write the pixel value, in this case it's the pixel value, to this RAM location, and this memory mapped IO mechanism will actually say that whenever you update this value, it should update this value on the screen. It will internally trigger commands to your graphics card. The OS is not explicitly going to issue these commands. These will be implicitly triggered. You will just read and write a region of memory. That is why it's called memory mapped. You will take this piece of buffer and you are mapping it to memory, and you are doing memory IO, which is much more efficient. You will just say, go write this value to location XYZ in RAM. Okay. This just happens to a special address, because whenever you update that, it actually updates the screen automatically for you. Okay. Same thing you can do with file IO. You can take a file and map it into RAM. Okay. And then rather than actually doing read or write to files, you can do read or write to memory. And this memory mapped IO will actually update the right location on the file for you. Okay, you have a question?
For graphics cards that have their own RAM, is that where that would go? Or would that still be on the main RAM?
Yes, so if the graphics card typically has its own RAM. So if you did memory mapped IO, that RAM is mirrored in the main RAM. So when you update this, that RAM gets updated, and then it will, the graphics card will output the right value to the screen. That's exactly what would happen in this case. But you are not issuing explicit commands. You just saved yourself the trouble. All you do is you update a region of memory, and that implicitly goes and updates something in the graph for somewhat more convenient. Okay. So, did interrupt base. There are only two more slides, so we'll do that quickly and wrap up for the day. The second last piece of hardware we want to study are timers and atomic instructions. Okay. So typically, as you know, your hardware has a clock built in, okay, that basically tells you what's the time. Using this clock, your hardware also supports what are called timers. Okay. As the name suggests, timer basically says you can basically have the timer go off. You insert a value into the timer saying, alert me after so many milliseconds or nanoseconds have passed. Okay, so then the timer will go off after that much period has elapsed. A very simple function which allows you to set a timer, and the timer, whenever the timer expires, it will raise an alert saying that the timer that you set has expired. That's what is supported in the hardware. Now what you can do with it is a variety of things. You can do most of the CPU scheduling or the process scheduling that we'll talk about actually depends on this one piece of hardware, the timer. Okay? So I said that you can switch from one process to another. How is that typically done? You basically, once you start executing a process, you set a timer saying this process can execute for the next 100 milliseconds. Okay, the process continues to execute. After 100 milliseconds have gone by, the timer raises an alert saying 100 milliseconds have elapsed. So OS says, okay, you executed for 100 milliseconds, time to execute something else. You got some share of the CPU, I want to execute another process. So it will now load this other process, start another timer, and so on. So this timer allows you to switch from one process to another. Okay. When we do CPU scheduling, we'll come back to this. But this very simple mechanism allows you to do a variety of things. And CPU scheduling being a key thing that you can do. Okay. And you can use timers for lots of other things. You can say, every 10 seconds, I want to go and do something. Okay. You write a process like that, it's going to actually insert 10 seconds into a timer, and when 10 seconds have elapsed, then it's going to do whatever you told it to do. All of those kinds of processes or applications you write depend on this piece of hardware called a timer. Okay, and timers themselves depend on a clock. So you have to have time before you can implement a timer. Okay. So that's timers. Interrupts, I think we are going to skip right now. And I'm going to talk a little bit about synchronization. Okay, so if you have taken 230, you did threads, then you did semaphores and locks and concurrency. Right? Yes? No?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. So the way this is actually implemented in hardware is through what is called a special atomic instruction called test and in this case I'm going to give one example. It's called a test and set instruction. So you need special hardware, right, to implement threads properly, to implement locks, to implement semaphores, all of the stuff that you have learnt in 230. The way it's actually implemented is you need some hardware support, special instructions in hardware, and you need some OS support. The hardware instructions are what are called atomic instructions. These are instructions that execute atomically. They do multiple things in an all or nothing way. Either the whole instruction executes or nothing executes. Okay? Test and set is one example of that. Okay? I'm going to come back to this when we come back, when we start looking at threads, and we'll look at how you can take this hardware feature, namely atomic instruction, and use it to implement threads. Okay? Thus far, you only used threads in 230. Now, in this class, when we come back to thread management, we'll see how to implement threads in the OS, okay? Implement threading support in the OS. But the only takeaway right now is to do that, you need some special instructions that are called atomic instructions, okay? Which we will come back to later. Okay? So, virtual memory we are going to skip. So, just summarize in a minute. So, we did like a quick refresher to architectural concepts. If you have forgotten concepts from 201 or 230, or for if some reason this material was not covered, please go read through this. If your questions, come back and ask next time or in the discussion section. But it's very important that you understand all of these things, because the OS concepts are going to build on this. You don't understand something here, when I talk about it, when I really go into the material for operating systems, you will not understand. Okay, so review this, come back and ask questions either during office hours or later. Okay, yes.